Welcome back to our series on Jeremiah and the Faithful Remnant, Surviving the Last Days. And we're looking at Jeremiah and his friends, and this is being sponsored by the Christadelphian Video Service. So we're going to look tonight at Jeremiah 36 and Jeremiah 45, because as we've said all along, the chapters of Jeremiah are, and they suffered enormously in these years under Jehoiakim. So you see, the fourth year of Jehoiakim was a very dreadful year for the fortunes of Israel. It was also the year that Daniel and his friends were taken into captivity to serve in the court of the king of Babylon, and many others were taken away by the Babylonians into captivity. It was a tragic year. Babylon began to dominate the world. They took away the cream of the land. The king's seed were taken away. And very sadly for Jeremiah, many of his Sunday school class come youth group were taken away as well and went into captivity. It was a tragic year. But also in this fourth year of Jehoiakim, other things were going on. We have the writing of the words of Jeremiah that we're going to read about in chapter 36, verse 1 and 2. Then we have the depression of Baruch in Jeremiah 45. And so we have once we've put the records together, we have a very telling story about what's going on in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, a year of gloom. The important thing now about this is now that the Babylonians have arrived, now that the Egyptians have failed to defend Israel, Jeremiah's words are starting to be heard by some people with much more respect. They could no longer ignore him until the time had come for the words of Jeremiah to be written down. We're going to see that even some of the worst of the people in the land began to think that they should start listening to the words of Jeremiah. You've got Jeremiah 36 open. You read there about a man called Elnathan, the son of Akbor. Now, Elnathan was the king's father-in-law. He was the father of Nehushta, who we talked about earlier on. He had murdered Urijah the prophet, dragging him back from Egypt, a friend of Jeremiah's. And in verse 25, when the servants of the king are saying, you need to listen to these words of Jeremiah, even Elnathan is saying, please, please, Jehoiakim, listen to what Jeremiah is saying. So even the worst of the people, even the murderous Elnathan, is starting to listen to Jeremiah. Many people were moved by the words of Jeremiah, as we're going to see. But one man wasn't moved, and that was the horrible King Jehoiakim. He was the one who burnt the scroll of Jeremiah. So let's now look at this man, Baruch. We'll see that God provided for Jeremiah a faithful friend and scribe. This man only appears in the record after the loss of Josiah. He only appears from the fourth of Jehoiakim onwards. He appears after the first captivity has taken place. Maybe he was the answer to the prayers of the lonely man Jeremiah. And I think particularly when many of his Sunday school class were taken away, that God provided a loyal friend who stayed with him for the rest of his time, in the rest of his life. Right to the very end, even in Egypt, Baruch was still by his side. His name means the light of Yah. His brother Seraiah, described as a quiet prince or a honorable prince, was Zedekiah's scribe and went to Babylon with Zedekiah. It appears to have been a very godly family. And he was a man of some influence, because later on when the people were rejecting the words of Jeremiah in chapter 43, they said, well, you're just being pushed around by Baruch. And so he was a man of influence. He wasn't just a humble scribe who didn't have any opinion. He was perceived by the people to be an influence on Jeremiah. Later on, we're going to see that he also had a number of important roles in the nation. When the city had fallen, the Babylonians appointed three men to rule the city, Gedaliah the governor, Jeremiah, and Baruch. So again, he was a capable administrator. He was Jeremiah's faithful scribe and companion for some 20 years and stayed with him right to the end in Egypt. He was the man that went out into the city and buried the title deeds to the block of land in Anathoth, which we read about in chapter 32. So he was very involved with Jeremiah for the rest of his life. So let's come now to Jeremiah 36 and to show you how this chapter must be divided up and how there must be insertions of two other chapters between verse 4 and 5. So here he is in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. He was commanded through Jeremiah to take a scroll and to write out all of Jeremiah's words that had been spoken to this point of time. So all of the words and all the prophecies of the first 22 years had to be written down into a scroll. And that's what Baruch had to do. So obviously Jeremiah was given recall of those words to actually make those speeches again, and they would be written down by the hand of Baruch. And that includes chapters 1 to 12, 14 to 20, chapters 23 and 26. They're all the chapters we know for sure are prior to the fourth year of Jehoiakim. So he would write them down. And this was an accumulation of the words of Jeremiah. The reason this had to be done was that in those days there were no recordings, there were no news broadcasts, there was no written record, there were no newspapers. And many of the people through the nation had not heard the words of Jeremiah firsthand. But now there would be copies made. Now these words could be read out in various places all over the land. And the words of Jeremiah would ring out through the whole nation because of the writing of Baruch. Well, that scroll was ultimately destroyed by the king Jehoiakim, and it had to be written out again. So at the end of this chapter, we find he's got to go write it all out again and to add a lot more words to it. Well, we do know that when he wrote it out the second time, he added chapter 25 to it. And so a last dreadful prophecy, chapter 25, is made and added to the words that were written out the second time. So this was a lot of writing for the scribe Baruch to go through. Now, just some interesting facts about this particular phase of the life of Jeremiah. Up until now, we've had Jeremiah speaking his own words, speaking in the first person. From here onwards, from chapter 36 onwards, or from the 40 of Jehoiakim onwards, the whole of the life of Jeremiah is written as a biography, and it's obviously from a close observer. So Baruch was now walking alongside Jeremiah wherever he went, recording day by day the experiences that Jeremiah went through and the words that he spoke from this point onwards. So there's a very distinct change in the way the language of the book is written, from being in the first person of Jeremiah in those early chapters, now going into the third person in the case of Baruch's writing about Jeremiah's life. And the record includes many details that only a very close friend or associate would know about Jeremiah and his thoughts. So Baruch was right there recording this for our sakes. We also get chapter 45, which is a very humbling account of his own fears, his own thoughts that God has to challenge, and the counseling that came to him via Jeremiah from God himself. So here was the writings of Baruch the scribe. Remember, Jeremiah's been doing things for 22 years, performing parables, giving resounding speeches. But because there was no permanent record, it now was being written down by Baruch. He took this scroll, wrote out the judgments of Jeremiah, and it was done with hope. The hope was in verse 7, it may be that people will present their supplication, return from their evil ways, because anger and fury is hanging over them. So the intent was to cause people to repent. Well, you can imagine what it was like writing out all the speeches of Jeremiah at this point of time. And when chapter 25 was added in, it absolutely crushed Baruch's hopes of a national revival. I believe up to this point, Baruch was hoping that there would be a national revival, there would be a great restoration of hope for the nation, that God will sort out the Babylonians. And he, being the scribe who had caused this to happen through his writings, would be an honored person, and it didn't happen. So when we go back to chapter 25, we actually have the chapter that was added in at the end of the writing of the words of Jeremiah. We need to go back there because it's very specifically included as part of it. So chapter 36 was in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. And then we read this, the word that came to Jeremiah, so this is a new prophecy, In the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, which was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. So the first year under Nebuchadnezzar, if this prophecy is given. So this is, while Baruch is writing out Jeremiah's words, a new prophecy is given. And here it is. And it actually, in verse 1, we have the dating of it. And then we go down to verse 13 for the timing of it. And it says this. And I will bring upon the land all my words which I have pronounced against it, says God, even all that is written in this book, which Jeremiah has prophesied against all the nations. You see, there is the proof that it was added to the words that Jeremiah had previously spoken. So, in that same year that the scroll is being written, chapter 25 is added, and is then included in the book of Jeremiah to that point of time. Now, we're not going to go through the whole chapter, because it's a chapter of tremendous appeal, as well as tremendous warning that the people must completely change their ways. So verse 8 to 9 is a prophecy of Babylonian invasion. Verse 11 to 12, a desolation of the land for 70 years, which was the first time that's ever mentioned. Verse 17 to 29, then a prophecy of the destruction the Babylonians will bring upon all the other nations of the Middle East. And then finally, we have an Armageddon section, a prophecy against the nations of all the earth. And you see that in verse 29, at the end of it, all the inhabitants of the earth. The end of verse 30, all the inhabitants of the earth. In verse 31, a controversy with the nations and all flesh. Verse 32, nation to nation, the coasts of the earth. Verse 33, the end of the earth, the end of the earth. So there's no doubt that the end chap verses in verse 30 to 38 are something which is still yet future for us, because it's about how the Babylonian invasion is going to be repeated, Armageddon, and the great slaughter that will follow as the word of and the punishment of God goes from nation to nation. So this prophecy of 25 against Israel and Judah and against all the nations of the current world at that particular time is going to have a tremendous repeat in the future. And that's all there in chapter 25 of Jeremiah, which was added to the words of Jeremiah written out by Baruch. So we need, don't we, to see how that this fits in with it. Now, this very stark message, including chapter 25, precipitated Baruch's personal crisis. Let's go back to chapter 36 and pick it up, because the timing is critical. So back in Jeremiah 36, we read this. In verse 5, and Jeremiah said to him, I am shut up, so he was under house arrest. I cannot go to the house of Yahweh. Therefore, you go and read in the scroll which you've written, the words of my mouth, on the fasting day. Well, when did he do that? Well, he did it in the fifth year, in verse 9. So the reading took place in the fifth year of Jehoiakim. So there's actually a loss of 9 to 12 months here. And this is critically important to what's happening to Baruch personally. By the time the reading took place, Nebuchadnezzar had come, humiliated Jehoiakim, taken the first captivity away, and put them under tremendously painful tribute, so that Jehoiakim had to impose great taxes upon the people. And the words of Jeremiah were now coming to pass with great rapidity on that nation. So what happened in that delay of that 9 to 12 months between the command that to write the scroll and the time to go and read it? What has happened to delay that reading? Well, it was the depression that Baruch went through. So we come now to chapter 45. And we notice again in verse 1, the word that Jeremiah the prophet spake unto Baruch the son of Neriah when he had written these words in a book or a scroll at the mouth of Jeremiah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim the son of Josiah king of Judah. So having written out the words, added chapter 25, then there's about a 12-month delay before he reads them. Why? Well, because he went into a classic depression. The present tense in the Hebrew, which means while he was writing it. So you can imagine, can't you, as he's writing out these words, and he starts to imagine the horror that he's writing down from what Jeremiah has been saying, that it brought to him a great depression. And so God sent Jeremiah to him. God could have spoken directly to Baruch, but no, he chose to send Jeremiah. Jeremiah had been through similar times himself of great depression and sadness, as we've seen in previous chapters. He was quite fit and able to go and talk to Baruch. And when you read about what happened, we have the words that Jeremiah would understand. These were the words of Jeremiah in chapter 15. You know, this great depression he'd been through. He says in chapter 15, verse 17, I sat not in the assembly of them that make merry nor rejoice. I sat alone because of your hand. You filled me with indignation. Jeremiah had felt alone. He'd felt forgotten. He'd felt withdrawn. He knew what Baruch was going through. He was the right man to send. Now, I want to talk about depression. Because in chapter 45, we have God dealing with Baruch's depression and sadness. Every time I've given this talk, I inevitably receive some criticism because people think I'm interfering in the medical psychological process. I'm not medically trained, but I have had experience with a number of people who have been through Great Depression, done my research. What I want to present is a biblical perspective. I do recognize that some depression has physical causes and requires medication. I am not suggesting people disregard their medical advice. What I am saying is this. Our God who made us is not unaware of our human weaknesses, and he provides ways for us to manage them. Sadness comes to everybody. Even Jesus sought to be alone when he heard of the death of John the Baptist. He said to his disciples, let us go apart for a time. As the cross loomed large before him, he began to be very heavy, says the record. He felt weighed down by the weight of responsibility and the pain and the suffering he knew was coming his way. We read of the Apostle Paul arriving at Athens alone, greatly concerned for the Thessalonians that he'd left behind in persecution, and the Philippians likewise. And he says, I was there in weakness and fear and much trembling. We read of Paul in the depths of the Roman prisons, unable to deal with the problems that are happening all around the ecclesial world. It must have been very depressing for him indeed. And depression is a very widespread thing. It used to be called in days gone by a nervous breakdown. In Australia, you know, they estimate that 1 in 24 people are suffering from depression of some kind. There's a tremendous cost in absenteeism and medical costs. It's amazing, isn't it, in an age of so many labor-free devices that so many people, and there are so many unsolvable issues in the world. Our media is invasive, and in many workplaces there's a spirit of madness being adopted by our employers who are trying to appear as woke and keep up with the world around us. There are plenty of reasons for us to be feeling the pressure. But let's define what depression really is. As I said, some has a physical basis, and it may be due to some chemical imbalance, and I'm not going to go into the area because it's not my expertise. Sometimes depressive tendencies run in families. It can be an inherited susceptibility. But often the cause is unknown. And it can come suddenly to anyone. I want to make that point. It can come suddenly to anyone. It can afflict the meek and the confident alike. It can hit the dynamic as much as the introspective. It can hit the highly active as well as the creative. Depression plays no favorites. Don't think it could never be you. What we do know is that depression often follows great personal loss. It might be the grief of losing a relative. It might be the loss of employment. It might be a major crisis in our family or ecclesia, or tough times economically that we're going through. Depression can strike very suddenly and very unexpectedly, and it usually follows a time of emotional exhaustion. And when we talk about depression, it's not just a sad episode. We all have those. Depression is where we reach the point that we can't bounce back, where the episodes become a spiral of negativity, and a sense of hopelessness descends upon us. It always contains a great sense of loss, and it can be very disconcerting to some to lose control of their life and their emotions. Let me talk about some of the manifestations of depression and sadness. One of the greatest manifestations is what we call the black hole experience. Winston Churchill coined the phrase the black dog, and of course he would normally cope with it with alcohol. But he had moments of great depression because of the ups and downs of his life, in and out of parliament, in and out of ministries. But he always had this problem with depression. In Asaph, we find Asaph describes it as sliding down into a crevasse, unable to stop yourselves going down into despair. So the black hole experience, this morose sadness and gloom, is the great common thing about depression. It's followed by losing interest in and pleasure in life, finding nothing positive to rejoice or hope in. And so it dents the hope that we have in our faith. Feelings of agitation, or conversely, lassitude or apathy. Some people get very highly strung and become quite irrational. OCD can be part of it. Other people just don't want to do anything. They want to sit around, lie in bed, and just feel apathetic. Very commonly, our sleep is affected one way or the other. Most common is tiredness. People feel, even though they've done nothing physical, they feel incredibly tired at night, going churning over the things that are bothering their mind. More depression symptoms are these. Poor eating habits. Some people won't eat and therefore lose weight. Other people eat excessively and gain weight, especially if they're not doing any exercise or going out. So again, it's a very, very vicious cycle. Well, this is the one which is perhaps the one which is the most painful of all. What comes with depression is that for even the most capable people, a sense of worthlessness and low self-esteem, feeling that they are no good to anyone, they might as well die, and you know, suicidal thoughts often enter in at this stage. Depressed people cannot concentrate or focus, and they have a poor memory. They often get their facts confused, their history confused, and they cannot even read a book because they just can't concentrate or focus. Therefore, they avoid pressure or decision-making. The phone ringing can set them off into alarm and panicking. Having to make decisions is almost impossible when you're going through depression. Introversion. This one we're going to see comes out in the case of Bayrak. Consuming self-pity. Woe is me. We're going to see that in verse 3, God feeds back the words of Bayrak saying, woe is me, woe is me. And it becomes a very self-centered, consuming self-pity when we are thoroughly depressed. When we're depressed, we're driven by feelings rather than by reason. And that, of course, is always a great danger. This one I found particularly common in people that I've tried to help. Wanting love, but wanting to be alone. You ring them up and say, can I take you out? Can I come around? No, I just want to be left alone. And so you oblige them and you hang up and you don't go. And that just makes their depression worse. Just a little note of experience from that. Don't ask if you can come, just turn up. You know, they want to be loved, but they'll tell you they want to be alone. And it's not uncommon for people who are depressed because they are mentally down, their body goes down with them. And psychosomatic illnesses follow. They start then to imagine even things that are not happening to their body. But the overwhelming thing is this sense of hopelessness, this loss of purpose, this loss of meaning, the loss of value for themselves. Now, before I move on to talk about how God deals with it, I want to just show you from the Bible that this is not a new thing. It's not just a new phenomenon, even though in the modern world we recognize it and we actually define it much better than the ancient world did. Number one is this. It is not a sin to be depressed. I want to say it again. It is not a sin to be depressed. Being depressed is not the evidence of a lack of faith. Our God knows the frailty of our frame. And so he's recorded a number of very faithful characters in the Bible who go through times of great sadness and depression. You think of Hannah. She was a woman of great faith. She wanted the fortunes of Israel to be restored. But she was falling apart inside because of her childlessness. Look at the manifestations that we find with Hannah. A constant weeping. A loss of appetite. A wanting to be alone. Refusing help that was offered by her husband. A withdrawal to be alone in the temple. A very strong focus on her own problem. She said, I am bitter of soul. You see, that's classic depression. And refused comfort and assurance that was offered by her husband. So, you know, Hannah was a classic case of somebody who went through a major depression. And we know that God gave her a great answer to her depression in the giving of Samuel. But before we leave Hannah as an example, just think about the story you know so well and what happened. Because in this case, we have a great example of how not to help somebody who's depressed. And it comes from the well-intentioned Elkanah, her husband. He was concerned for her because she was not eating, she was always crying. And he makes a classic mistake in his frustration with her. And he says this, am I not better than 10 sons? Well, to put it in modern language, I can't see why you should be depressed. You've got me. Well, in Israel, a childless woman was regarded as being a failure. It was no comfort to her watching Peninnah with the children of her husband. For him to say, you've got me, was a very bitter pill indeed. And then Eli mistakes her grief for drunkenness. In the end, she put the matter in God's hands. So, you know, be careful about how you try and help people. We're going to show at the end some things that we need to take on as we try and help those who are depressed. Let's talk about another person who was depressed. Come to Job chapter 23 and pick it up in verse 8 to 10. Because Job went through a very terrifying experience with the loss of his children and his possessions. And one of the statements of Job in Job 23, verse 8 to 10, tells us about his confusion about what God was doing in his life. And it reads like this. Behold, I go forward, but lo, he's not there. And backward, and I can't perceive him. On the left hand, where he doth work, but I cannot behold him. He hideth himself on the right hand, but I cannot see him. So Job is confused. I can't find what God's doing with me in these trials. But he's still confident. But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. So there's a very understandable sense of hopelessness and gloom. You've only got to read his words in Job chapter 3 to see how low that he got. He wished he'd never been born. But he comes out a better person with a much deeper view of God. When we go to the life of David, we see the full cycles of human emotion, of guilt, of loneliness, of fear, of a persecution complex. In so many Psalms, we see David working through those feelings of depression, those feelings of loneliness. In Psalm 73, we have Asaph, a classic case of depression. He felt he was slipping away into the great gloom and into the pit of despair. His feet were almost gone. That's a very common experience of those who are going through depression. And we could quote you lots of others like Jonah and John Mark and Paul and King Saul at the early stage of his life going through depression. Let's talk about Elijah because here is the classic case in the Bible of a highly motivated, zealous individual who could rise to great heights of faith and then could crash into depths of despair. Now think what happened after the incredible miracle on Mount Carmel. Running before the chariot of Ahab, rain pouring behind them as he goes down the valley of Jezreel. And when he gets there, the words of Jezebel frighten him to death. Let's pick up the record in the 1 Kings chapter 19. The transformation of the powerful, dynamic Elijah when he comes face to face with the completely unrepentant arrogant will. And he collapses into depression because of it. Now let's notice what he says. In verse 3, and when he saw that, when he saw the threat of Jezebel, he was depressed. And we know that because what's the first thing he does? He wants to be alone. So he sends his servant away. Why would you do that? You see, this is the classic sign of depression. I want to be left alone. And then he went for himself a day's journey. He's now running away. He's now not worried about what God wants him to do. He's now doing things for himself. He's becoming self-absorbed. Then in verse 4, we have this sense of worthlessness. He's hiding in a cave. Or firstly, under a juniper tree. And his hopes are all dashed. And the classic symptoms in verse 5, withdrawn from supporters, got a loss of appetite, and he's sleepy. He just lies down to sleep under this juniper tree. And he's saying, I am no better than my fathers. I'm useless. I'm worthless. And God sent an angel to provide for him. Now, this lasted for 6 weeks. He was still morose and bitter all the way to Horeb. Took him a long time to get there. He was tired. He had no energy. A man that had run before the chariot of Ahab's got no energy. So he goes part of his journey and then he sleeps. Part of his journey and then he sleeps. And the angel keeps him alive by providing food for him. All of this 6 week journey down to Horeb. Where's the dynamic prophet now? This sense of being alone. I only am left. And they sit right away. And he says, look, you take my life. And he's got suicidal thoughts, as well as fears that they're going to destroy him. He's got no sense of worth anymore. And his reply to God was accusing God of not caring, of being unreasonable. One of the things about depression is that much of our reasoning becomes illogical, which is why we need to have it fed back to us. Where was the positive thoughts about the raised child at Zarephath, about the ravens, the fire from heaven, about Obadiah, the rain, the answer to his prayers? Where were those positive things? They were lost in the black hole of depression. So you see, there are many Bible examples telling us that this is not something new. Let's go back to Barak now in Jeremiah 45 and see how God deals with depression. And that's the critical thing. You will find any number of books, any amount of advice out there on how we can cope with depression. But I want to show you how God deals with Barak's depression, because it's the only counseling session we have in the scripture. Well, God, who knows the human mind, knows what to say. Unfortunately today, some of our psychiatrists are very humanistic. They love to create people to become victims. And unfortunately, some of them like to blame religion as being part of the problem. Much of the advice of modern-day psychiatrists is you need to look after yourself first, or to take more drugs, or go to therapy. And none of them provide a spiritual component as part of the process of recovery. So let's look at what God does. These are God's steps to recovery. Well, the first step, when you're counseling a person who is depressed, is feedback. So you take their own words, their own statements, and you feed them back. Now, the very typical symptoms are here. God says in verse 2, Barak, this is what I hear you saying. Now, this is feedback. So, because, you know, God through Jeremiah is saying, Barak, I have heard what you are saying in private. And this is what it is. You're saying, woe is me. Now, for Yahweh has added to my grief, to my sorrow. I fainted to my sighing, and I find no rest. So look at that. I want you to just, in verse 3, just color in the I, the me, and the my, and the, it's very self-centered. There's a consuming self-pity here. You know, Barak means blessed. He says, woe is him. he can't sleep. And you see, there's nothing in that verse 3 about how God's feeling about the situation. There's no solution here. There's no prophet being seen at all. It's all about depression. So when we are feeling depressed, it's very useful to hear what we're actually saying. Remember what God did with Elijah. What are you doing here, Elijah? And he made him repeat it before and after the earthquake, the fire, and the still small voice. What are you doing here, Elijah? And you see, God is trying to get us to face our own words. Because in doing so, we see where we have exaggerated or overrated the issues. Careful feedback will help us to begin to articulate our own solution. So in giving feedback, what do you mean by that? Why did you say that? Why do you think these people don't like you? Why is it that you're letting this get on top of you? So feedback actually is the first step. Make people say what they're expressing. Well, step number 2 is a reality check. This is what God said to Barak. Barak, your problem is you're seeking great things for yourself. Seek them not. For behold, I will bring evil upon all flesh, says Yahweh. What I'm going to give you is I'm going to spare your lives. You see, Barak had hoped that his writings would change the nation. There would be a great revival to be promoted because of what he had done for the nation using the words of Jeremiah. And God's aware of his motives. And God says, Barak, some things will not change. You're distressed now because the nation's going to be shattered. It's going to be shattered, Barak. It can't change. It's going to get worse than what it is now. It's all going to go. The nation, the people, the temple, it's all going to go. He doesn't soften the blow. He doesn't say, oh, it'll all be all right. No, he says, Barak, it's going to get worse. Maybe Barak had possessions. He certainly had ambitions. Like all Jews, he had national pride. He revolted at the idea of the Babylonians destroying his nation. Maybe he wanted to get promotion. Whatever it was, he was seeking great things for himself. He had to learn the lesson. Barak, life is hard. Life can be disappointing. But there's work to be done. There are many people who suffer depression from unreal expectations. The modern world promotes so many false images. The advertising industry uses all kinds of strategies to get us to buy things and to believe that happiness comes from the things that you own. But life's all about fun and self-satisfaction. But the reality is different. People follow after those things. They get mired in debt they can't pay. They lose relationships chasing money. They end up frustrated and so get depressed. And it's no different for those of us in the truth. We are not promised unfettered happiness, easy times. There will be conflicts within and without as we try to raise spiritual thinking. In the last days, there will be disappointments and defections from the truth. There will be false prophets leading some away. Like Jeremiah, we have to try and save the remnant. Like Elijah, we have to go looking for the 7,000 who've not bowed the knee to the world in which they live. So step 2 is a reality check. Things may not improve. We have to cope with the reality that we're faced with. Well, step number 3 is a focus on gratitude. Let's think about the focus on gratitude. You see, Barak had been promised in verse 7 that his life would be given him for a prey. It's very similar to what we read in chapter 15 and verse 11. He was incredibly depressed, at times suicidal. So, when I just come, I'll bring a book to read and I'll just sit and read to make sure you're okay. And he did that for weeks on end. And the book he brought, of course, was a pioneer work. And he sat there reading. And every so often he would turn to the brother who was on the bed and say, well, I read something interesting. And he'd give him a point from the book. And eventually the brother came good. But you see, he sat there for a long time, just like the angel did with Elijah. You have to listen and give feedback. You don't lecture. It's very typical in times of depression. Carers need to know how to speak a word in season to those who are weary and cast down and depressed. And there are many ways to gently feed in the spirit, the scriptural mind. Never make hasty judgments. Remember Eli accusing Hannah. Remember Job's friends, loyal but wrong. He called them miserable comforters because of their hasty judgments. They didn't say right things about God. Be very careful of the tendency to interpret providence for the wounded soul. I've seen some terrible examples of this being done with people. Well, the reason this happened to you was, and then some old crotchet comes out, or some old thing to do. Every time God said, Jeremiah, get back to work. Jeremiah, go on to do this. We must go on continuing to do the things that God requires us to do, including prayer. Accept the reality, things might not change. Job would always miss the children he'd lost. Elijah had to be taken away from the scene of Israel for quite a time that he might learn what was really important. Not fly from heaven, but the still small voice. Things did not get better when he was taken away. You see, we have to accept the reality. Barak was told, Barak, it's all going to go. It's not going to be saved. But you go on believing in God. In the end, God will wipe away all tears from the eyes of his faithful servants. So accept the realities of life. We cannot change everything. Then we must count our blessings and express gratitude to God for them. A wise man said this, all happy people are first grateful people. Even in the dark hours, we must recall God's love shown to us in the death of his son, the promise of his care, the faithful friends he surrounds us with, our family, and the promises and the joy set before us. We must count our blessings. And then we come to perhaps what I think is perhaps one of the greatest steps to get out of depression. Look out what I wanted him to do for the word of God and for the truth in those days. He was preserved through the fall of Jerusalem and finally went to Egypt to support the aged Jeremiah. He inspired the remnant, both then and now, to keep the words of God faithfully and to diminish not a word. But above all, Barak shows us the path out of sadness and depression to regain his courage, to be active, to get out there and to take on the evil Jehoiakim by the words of Jeremiah. Why don't you leave a conclusion with you? Again, there's some very powerful words I found in reading up on this subject. And it's